should see Leviticus chapter 5 as but a continuation of chapter 4. In fact, the specific sacrificial ritual of chapter 4 extends into the first 13 verses of chapter 5, but then it changes. Put another way, the uses for the Hata'at sacrifice, the purification offering, are ordained from Leviticus 4, verse 1 through Leviticus 5, verse 13, but at verse 15, things change to a different but completely complementary kind of offering. Just as most Bible translators have called the sacrificial offering of Leviticus 4 the sin offering, they also tend to call the various offerings of Leviticus chapter 5 sin offerings, although some translators use the words guilt offerings. Now keep in mind that in Torah class, we are calling the sacrificial offering of Leviticus 4 the purification offering, which translates the Hebrew word hata'at. In reality, though, a new type of offering is presented to us about halfway through chapter 5. All right, for the new type of offering that begins in verse 14 of chapter 5, we shall call it the reparation offering. Okay, and it will become apparent why I have chosen to use that word. Even more importantly, the different issues that the Hata'at and the Yasham sacrifices deal with. So open your Bibles to Leviticus chapter 5. Leviticus chapter 5. If a person who is a witness, sworn to testify, sins by refusing to tell what he has seen or heard about the matter, he must bear the consequences. If a person touches something unclean, whether the carcass of an unclean wild animal, a domestic animal, or a reptile, he is guilty, even though he may not be aware that he is unclean. If he touches some human uncleanness, no matter what the source of his uncleanness is, and is unaware of it, then when he learns of it, he's guilty. If someone allows to slip from his mouth an oath to do evil or to do good, and he doesn't remember that he clearly spoke this oath, then no matter what it's about, when he learns of it, he's guilty. A person guilty of any of these things is to confess in what manner he sinned and bring his guilt offering to Adonai for the sin he committed. It is to be a female from the flock, either a lamb or a goat, as a sin offering, and the priest will make atonement for him in regard to a sin. If he can't afford a lamb, he is to bring as his guilt offering for the sin he committed two doves or two pigeons for Adonai. The one is a sin offering, the other is a burnt offering. He is to bring them to the priest, who will offer the one for sin offering first. He is to wring its neck, but not remove the head. Sprinkle some of the blood of the sin offering on the side of the altar and drain out the rest of the blood at the base of the altar. It is a sin offering. He is to prepare the second as a burnt offering in the manner prescribed. Thus the Kohen will make atonement for him in regard to the sin which he committed, and he will be forgiven. But if his means are insufficient, even for two doves or two young pigeons, then he's to bring as his offering for the sin he committed 2 quarts of fine flour for a sin offering. He is not to put any olive oil or frankincense on it, because it's a sin offering. He's to bring it to the Kohen, and the Kohen is to take a handful of it as a reminder portion and make it go up in smoke on the altar on top of the offerings for Adonai made by fire. It's a sin offering. Thus the Kohen will make atonement for him in regard to the sin he committed concerning any of these things, and he'll be forgiven. The rest will belong to the Kohanim, the priests, as with a grain offering. Adonai said to Moses, if anyone improperly and inadvertently sins in regard to the holy things of Adonai, he's to bring as his guilt offering for Adonai a ram without defect from the flock, or its equivalent in silver shekels, using the sanctuary shekels, the standard, according to your appraisal of its value. It is a guilt offering. In addition, he is to make restitution for whatever he did wrong in regard to the holy thing. Moreover, he is to add to that 1/5 and give it to the Kohen. Then the Kohen will make atonement with the ram of the guilt offering, and he will be forgiven. If someone sins by doing something against any of the mitzvot of Adonai concerning things which should not be done, he is guilty. even if he's unaware of it, and he bears the consequences of his wrongdoing. He must bring a ram without defect from the flock, or its equivalent according to your appraisal, to the Kohen for a guilt offering. The priest will make atonement concerning the error which he committed, even though he was unaware of it, and he'll be forgiven. It is a guilt offering. He is certainly guilty before Adonai. Adonai said to Moses, if someone sins and acts perversely against Adonai by dealing falsely with his neighbor in regard to a deposit or security entrusted to him, by stealing from him, by extorting him, or by dealing falsely in regard to a lost object he has found, or by swearing to a lie, if a person commits any of these sins, then he sinned and is guilty. He is to restore whatever it was he stole or obtained by extortion, whatever was deposited with him, or the lost object which he found, or anything about which he has sworn falsely. He is to restore it plus restore it in full, plus an additional one-fifth. He must return it to the person who owns it on the day when he presents his guilt offering. He is to bring it as his guilt offering to Adonai, a ram, without defect from the flock or its equivalent according to your appraisal, to the Kohen. It is a guilt offering. Thus the Kohen will make atonement for him before Adonai. He'll be forgiven in regard to whatever it was he did that made him guilty. Okay, verses 1 through 13 of chapter 5 deal with a specific type of sin that is generally called the sin of omission. Things we should have done, but we didn't do. And if we're to understand the rest of the Old Testament, then we need to grasp and remember that there are various classes and categories and levels of sin. We've already been introduced to the concept of intentional versus unintentional sins is the first major fork in the road. That is, if a sin is unintentional, meaning not high-handed, then one or more of the many sacrificial rituals of the Levitical sacrificial system can atone for it. But if a sin is intentional, there is no remedy. The sinner must be executed. So far, we have looked at the unintentional class of sins, and Leviticus 4 introduced us to a subdivision of unintentional sin called inadvertent, an action that was an error. It was an accident. Leviticus 5, chapters 1 through 13, show us another subdivision of the unintentional sin called inadvertent, an action that was an error, an accident. All right. But now we get into something called the sins of omission, something different. And the idea is that something was called for in the law, but it wasn't done. And it occurred because somebody honestly forgot, or they weren't paying attention, or for some reason they were just incapable of doing it. Maybe it was illness, an accident, something like that. And we are given examples of what sorts of things this class of sin, this unintentional omission, encompasses. And the first example is of someone who hears of a public proclamation that anyone knowing the facts of a criminal incident that needs to be adjudicated should come forward. But they ignore the call. So they're guilty of the sin of omission. This is not a person who was involved in the incident. They just maybe know something that could shed some light on the matter. Now, what's interesting to me is that the biblical, or at least the Hebrew, definition of the words inadvertent and omission don't quite fit our typical modern-day definition. It would seem to me that this person who refuses to come forward is doing so both intentionally and actively. Yet in the mind of God, this is one example of a type of sin he defines as a sin of omission. Further, the Lord says, this person is guilty, meaning a punishment is due to him. Yet he can avoid this punishment by means of the proper sacrifice. Now, the ancient Hebrew commentators noticed this problem, and they came to the conclusion that since the person who refused to come forward only had information, had otherwise committed no crime, that what that person did was to be somewhat negligent in his duty. That is, he neglected to do his civil obligation. Now, it's not uncommon in the church world for a person to notice wrongdoing. Say they see someone pilfer a piece of furniture or enter areas of the premises where they don't belong, and the witness decides to say nothing about it. Usually the rationale is they want to be merciful. They don't want to be a tattletale. Or they don't think that it's Christian to get a fellow believer in trouble. Well, the Lord says, think again. When you do that, you have just incurred guilt in his eyes. It's your duty to report whatever information you have about whatever wrongdoing that you may have witnessed. The next example of an unintentional sin of omission is what happens when a person comes into contact with any unclean thing, unclean meaning impure. And in verse 2, we're given three categories of unclean things, and they're all concerning dead things. These categories are the carcass of a wild animal, the carcass of a domesticated animal, and the carcass of a reptile, a snake, or any kind of animal that creeps along the ground. But it also says the person who became ritually unclean by touching one of these things was unaware of it. But later, he became aware of it, and therefore he had been running around in a state of impurity without knowing it. So the idea here is that a person has become defiled, but then went some amount of time without realizing his impure state, so that made him guilty. So while the act of becoming unclean is generally not a sin, it means that one didn't do something of a criminal nature, doing nothing about it, when you find out about it, that's a sin. How could one come in contact with an impure animal and not know about it? Well, it could be as simple as walking along and stepping on some tiny little frog and being unaware of it. But when you get back to your tent, your wife says, "Oh, yuck, there's a dead frog stuck on the bottom of your sandal. Oh, ick, get it out of here." But more often, it had to do with eating cattle or sheep that under normal circumstances were perfectly acceptable for food, meaning they were kosher, ritually clean, but for some reason, this time it was not ritually clean. For instance, since almost all meat eaten was part of a sacrifice, maybe that sacrifice was defective in some way, procedurally speaking, and you didn't find out about it until after you ate it. Or perhaps someone gave you some meat, you ate it, and then it turned out that the animal from whence it came was killed by a wild beast, thereby making what was otherwise kosher now unfit for eating. A third example is when a person touches human impurity. For instance, a man touches his wife after she gives birth, but the allotted time has not passed, and she is yet to perform her required purification ceremony. This is because immediately upon giving birth, a woman is considered to be in an unclean state. Or a man has sex with his wife who suddenly begins her period, for example. Or a woman during her cycle is considered ritually unclean. So now the man has accidentally become unclean, but he didn't notice it. He finds out later. See, these types of uncleanness are of a lesser severity as opposed to one of the most severe kinds of impurity, touching something that is dead, particularly a human corpse. Notice that impurity from touching a dead body is not included because stringent purification rituals have to be performed if that happens. Now, I hope you're beginning to see this important developing principle that guilt in God's eyes, and this is tough, is not a matter of a person being aware of his guilt. It's a matter of either not doing something that you should have or doing something that you should not have. all in accordance with God's laws and commandments. To carry that theme a little further, the fact that someone is unaware that by nature he was born a sinner, something that really isn't even his own fault, doesn't change the reality that to God, that person is in a perpetually guilty state. In other words, a person who has never heard the gospel message is in the same basic condition as someone who has heard it but has rejected it. Both bear guilt, because awareness or unawareness of your guilt has no bearing on the matter. And that same principle that was in effect in the Old Testament remains in effect today. The fourth example given in verse 4 is when a person makes an oath, makes a vow, a promise to do something, whether that vow is to do evil or to do good, and then time passes and he or she forgets about it. That is, they don't do what's been vowed. Then that person is guilty before God of an inadvertent sin of omission. Now, this is kind of interesting, particularly the part about whether the oath is to do evil or good. See, first the idea here is that the person has sworn in the name of God to do something. It is a vow, because by definition, this person has invoked Jehovah's name. Second, is that it doesn't matter what the nature of the promise was. It could have been something that you impulsively promised revenge, even to kill your spouse for making you angry. I mean, maybe you really didn't even mean it. You just did it rashly. But not following through makes the person who made the vow guilty of a sin of omission in God's eyes. The point, of course, is not that one should carry out a vow even if it's an evil thing. Later in the Old Testament and again in the New, we get warnings against making vows to God altogether. We're told, just make our yes, yes, and our no, no. Invoking God's name carries very serious consequences, and we're better off to avoid it. See, we tend in modern times to invoke God's name very casually and carelessly. And the more we do it, the more it just becomes this unconscious habit. And the far more likely we are to just forget about whatever it was that we actually vowed in the first place. Now, in the ancient days, oaths and vows were more serious matters than they are in our day, because there were fewer written legal codes and therefore fewer lawyers, fewer contracts. Vows and oaths were the traditional method of making legal agreements. In Western society, written promises or vows called contracts is the norm. And part of the basis of our legal system is that an illegal contract is not binding on the parties. What that means is that, for example, you sign a contract, in biblical terms, you make a vow with a man to steal a car. That man steals the car and then he sells it to you for a cheap price. You give him half the money when he agrees to do the dirty deed, and the rest when he turns that stolen car over to you. But instead, he takes your money. He never shows up with the car. In modern Western law, you cannot then take this person to court demanding your down payments returned, because the nature of the subject of the contract itself is an illegal act. And a contract concerning an illegal act, in biblical terms, an evil act, is not binding on the parties. But here in Leviticus, we see that making a promise of any kind in the name of Jehovah, whether the nature of the promise is to do something against God's law or in accordance with God's law, is binding as God sees it. Obviously, to vow to do something against God's law, such as promising to murder somebody or to steal from them, carries a double whammy with it. The bottom line is that you and I may impulsively and insincerely make a vow invoking God's name and then just kind of blow it off, forget about it, or change our minds because we think, ooh, that was not such a good thing. God doesn't forget about it. It makes us guilty in His eyes when we don't fulfill a vow made in His name. So let's follow the biblical advice and avoid making vows in the first place, unless they are of the most serious and necessary nature. Now, verse 5 presents us with a very important and overlooked aspect of the sacrificial system. It surprises people. Confession. It's common for Christians to think and to accuse the ancient Jews of mechanical legalism for their following of the sacrificial system. In fact, the first step for seeking forgiveness of sins in the Levitical sacrificial system is confessing to Yahweh that you have sinned against Him. And we're going to find passages all throughout the Old Testament that makes it clear that one must have a repentant and contrite heart, mind, in order for the animal sacrifice to even be efficacious for you. Certainly, we were going to read again and again in the Bible of those hypocrites who go through all the rituals, but they're proud and they're inwardly unrepentant. But we have exactly that same thing happen in modern Christianity. We have many professed believers go through all the outward motions, but the trust and condition of the heart are completely lacking. For each of these first four cases of inadvertent sins of omission listed in Leviticus 5, the prescribed sacrifice for it is called out in verse 6. And it is a hatat sacrifice that consists of a female sheep or goat. Now, we're not going to review the procedure. You can just refer to the last couple of lessons if you want to know more about it. From verses 7 through 13, we get a list of what animals may be substituted for the worshiper simply, rather when the worshiper simply does not have the financial means to bring the prescribed animal, a female sheep or goat, for this hatat offering. For instance, if he can't provide a lamb, then two pigeons or two doves will suffice. As cheap as and as plentiful as birds were, if that person was utterly destitute and couldn't even afford birds, then he could bring 2 quarts of semolina, fine flour, instead. Also notice that the usual requirement when offering up grain for sacrifice is that olive oil and frankincense, and a very expensive luxury, normally had to be added to the mix, but in this case it's waived. So what we see is a sliding scale set up not only according to the class the person belongs to, high priest, whole congregation, tribal leader, individual, but even how much that individual person is able to reasonably provide. I mean, remember, this concerns only this particular sacrifice, the hatat. But also notice that under no circumstance does even the absolute poorest person get by providing no sacrificial offering. At the least, some semolina flour is required. Again, we see this important God principle being set up. And boy, this is big. No one is exempt from paying a ransom for his sin to the Lord. Nobody. And with the advent of Christ, however, the sliding scale ended. Christ is the fixed and unchangeable price for everyone, rich or poor. Let me mention something here that's quite interesting, and I'm not sure I have an answer for it, that I'd take to the bank. A foundational biblical principle is that only blood can atone for sin. Yet, here we see that the absolute poorest person, in this case, can provide grain, plant life, and not animal life to expiate his guilt. The only reason I can come up for this anomaly is that what is being really dealt with is sin caused by impurity. Sin that comes from not realizing that one has become accidentally impure. It's not that one's sin has made one impure. It's that one's impurity is become sin. I've said on a number of occasions that the typical Christian doctrine that God doesn't grade sins on a curve is simply not at all borne out by the Holy Scriptures. Here is one of the finer examples. Inadvertent sins of omission whereby even grain can be used to pay for the guilt. This is the absolute lowest category of something that can even be remotely called a sin. And obviously God makes some kind of special allowance for its low level. This section also gives me an opportunity to show you how we're to understand the concept of taking the Bible literally. Now, I've taught you before that literal means that we're to seek out what the words or the phrase actually means, as opposed to trying for some direct word-for-word translation, which can, believe me, often produce a sentence that's nearly unintelligible. In addition, the meaning of a phrase must be taken in its cultural sense at the time it was written, and it should not be allegorized or taken as a metaphor unless the context indicates that that is what the phrase is meant to be. Verse 7, depending on your version, starts out like this. If he can't afford a lamb, others might say, but if his means did not suffice, something like that. But the Hebrew words being translated here are im ein yado meseget, translated directly word for word, if his hand cannot reach. Now, what does that mean to you? If his hand cannot reach. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us. You see, that phrase, if his hand cannot reach, is a fossilized Hebrew idiom, which simply means in modern Western English, if somebody can't afford it. That's what it means. So here we have a good literal translation in our Bibles, but it's not a word-for-word translation, or all but the most versed Bible scholar in ancient Hebrew would be lost trying to understand what it means. Verse 14 takes us to a new type of sacrificial offering then, the asham, because we will be introduced now to a new class of sins. And here we are represented with the concept of paying a penalty for an act of misbehavior. This is totally different than what went on in the first 13 verses of chapter 5, whereby a person did not misbehave. Rather, he accidentally contracted an impurity, and when he didn't realize it, it made him guilty. But a better word than penalty is reparation, because reparation indicates something that's owed. When we get a speeding ticket and we pay a fine, it is a penalty in a more pure sense. It's not that we're paying something that's owed. It's that we made a legal error, we've been fined, and now as a punishment, we pay a fine. After we pay that fine, we're not forgiven or excused. Paying the fine doesn't somehow make up or substitute for breaking the law. As a matter of fact, as we know in Florida, getting a traffic ticket and paying for it doesn't end the process. We're then assessed points, which can affect our insurance rates. Now, a reparation in the sense meant here in Leviticus 5, in fact, does bring restoration and forgiveness. It's not about punishment. And because one has transgressed against God's holiness, the asham sacrifice pays reparations for the person who was the transgressor in order that he indeed has this required debt owed to God paid in full. and it is therefore a restored relationship to God that he gains. So we are going to call the Asham offering the reparation offering. Now, it might seem that these different types of sacrifices that we've so far discussed, the Ola, Minka, Zeva, Hata'at, Nadi Asham, are really only different from each other in minor ways, and that we're slicing this onion awfully thin as we try to draw distinctions among them. But my hope is that after we've been introduced to each of these, and then a little bit later in Leviticus, as we watch them applied in case law, we're going to begin to develop a fuller sense of them that I believe was intended. And it is that sin and forgiveness are complex and they're multifaceted. One way to think of it, of all we've learned so far about the sacrificial system, is that it gives us a set of tools and examples that describes not only what sin is, but its effects and what can be done about those effects. Gordon Wenham uses these tools and examples as models. So using his term of models, the Olah, the burnt offering, gives us a model which is personal in nature. That is, we see a human being who is declared guilty by Yehovah for his sin nature. Then we see an animal having to die in his place as a substitute in order that communication and peace between God and that particular man can occur. The Zeva, the peace offering that most translators label as the sin offering, and I believe that's very incorrect, uses medical terminology to look at yet another aspect of sin. Sin makes the world so polluted that God can't dwell there any longer. Therefore, the blood of an innocent animal becomes the antidote which counteracts or disinfects the polluted sanctuary, after which Yehovah may once again be with his people. The Asham, the reparation offering, gives us yet another view of sin by giving us a commercial model. And as we will see as we study the Asham, sin creates a debt which man incurs to God. The debt is paid. Reparation is made by means of the blood of an innocent animal. Now, I took you off on this tangent because we've all heard preachers and teachers present their takes on sin and the effects of sin. And usually each denomination will choose within their overall doctrine one or two aspects of sin as their effect of choice, and then declare that all the other effects of sin are somehow not valid, or they're of lesser importance, or not even worthy of discussion. What we see in Leviticus is that God is attempting to teach we earthbound creatures some of the most basic aspects of sin and its awful consequences. And the way he seems to be accomplishing this is by breaking it down into bite-sized chunks, somewhat simplistic chunks, so that we can digest it. And these bite-sized chunks are the various kinds of sacrifices and rituals and their specific purposes that God's teaching to his people. After all, when we address sin, we're dealing with a spiritual matter. And in our current physical condition, we're simply unable to comprehend very much about the spiritual universe. Unsaved people are unable to comprehend even less than we as born-again Christians are capable. So what exactly was the Asham for? Well, as we move through the Torah, we find that many of the laws and commandments and rituals specified in Leviticus are further fleshed out, expanded upon, and they're given much more detail in Numbers and Deuteronomy. The Asham isn't any different. So for now, we're going to cover primarily what we find in Leviticus about the Asham. Beginning in verse 14, the first case of the kind of sin that the Asham sacrifice is meant to atone for is described as sins against the Lord, or more specifically, inadvertent sins against the Lord's sacred property. A great deal of commentary has been written by Jewish rabbis and ancient Hebrew sages on exactly what constituted an inadvertent sin and what exactly was the Lord's sacred property. And I hope you'll soon gain a sympathetic outlook on the usually honest attempt by these ancient Jewish religious authorities to try to define what are often very generalized commandments and rituals that we find in the Torah, because these commentaries are what form the basis of the Talmud. Now, what we should not be so quick to judge is that these writers, thinking of themselves as self-important or as men who tried to alter God's commandments, their purpose, generally but not always, was noble. It was meant to actually find ways to carry out God's commandments, many of which were very hazy in their biblical explanations, just as we encounter here in Leviticus 5. Now, some of the possibilities these learned men include in the category of inadvertent sins against the Lord's sacred property are eating holy food. Now, we find a reference to this in Leviticus 22:14, which is generally defined as a non-priest eating food that should only have been eaten by priests, or priests eating food in their home that was given as a sacrifice, which means it should only have been consumed at the tabernacle area. Another was failing to fulfill some types of vows or failing to present a prescribed tithe at the sanctuary for some type of dedication ceremony. Even then, Leviticus 5 seems to break these down into two different types: inadvertently sinning against the Lord and being aware of it, and inadvertently sinning against the Lord and not being aware of it until sometime later. What's important to grasp is that these particular sins or trespasses are of a more serious level, because they are considered to be directly against the Lord. You know, all sins are in some way against Jehovah, because every sin, by definition, involves going against God's commandments, against His laws, against His will in some fashion. In our Bibles, in Leviticus 5:14, we find the English word sin, or trespass, and the Hebrew word that this is translating is ma'al. And ma'al is one of several Hebrew words that winds up getting all lumped together and then translated into English as sin or trespass. But ma'al is used in Hebrew to denote primarily the most serious sins. And later in the Torah, we're going to find this same Hebrew word to describe the sin, the ma'al of adultery, and the me'al of worshiping other gods, idolatry. We'll find a certain king of Judah committing a me'al because he wanted to personally burn incense on the altar of incense to honor Jehovah, even though the privilege is assigned only to priests. In fact, we find that depending on whether the sin against the Lord was known immediately or not realized until sometime later, that brought about slightly different sacrificial rituals for atonement. Sinning against the Lord's sacred property and being aware of it at the time is not what's being addressed in verses 14 through 16. Or rather, I'm sorry, it is what's being addressed in verses 14 through 16. Sinning against the Lord's sacred property and not being aware of it until sometime later is discussed in verse 17. So if the worshiper was aware of his transgression at the time it occurred, he was to bring a male sheep, a ram, which would have been at least 1 year old, as his offering. This was to be a perfect ram. By the way, not all sacrifices required the animal to be perfect. This one had to display the highest quality of perfection. And as a further definition of the sacrificial reparation, we get a very vague an often disputed instruction that the sacrifice is supposed to equal some monetary value as measured by the temple standard for silver shekels. let me attempt to untangle this a little bit, because this monetary system was still in use in Jesus' day. And this will help you get a picture of some of the Bible stories which took place in New Testament times. First of all, a shekel is somewhat of a fixed monetary unit, just like a dollar is a fixed monetary unit. However, in more ancient times, just how much of a particular precious metal was contained in a shekel varied. Shekels could have been made of copper, bronze, or silver. Further, the person who minted those coins could have been a king, could have been a very wealthy man, or it could have been the temple authorities. And all of these different kinds of shekels were floating around at the same time, so that there was disparity between the value of the various shekels depending on who minted it and what kind of metal it consisted of. Early in Israelite history, it was determined that when money was to be used for religious purposes, the standard for it was to be the weights and measures used by the temple authority. By Jesus' day, actually a bit before, a system was set up whereby money changers would exchange shekels minted by an aristocrat or a king for shekels that were minted by the temple. Now, naturally, these money changers charged a commission for this service, and they often cheated the people who had no other choice than to use these official licensed money changers, who were required to give a portion of their profits to the high priest. What a racket. That is, what the whole deal was with Jesus overturning these money changers' tables in the temple grounds was all about this commercial foreign money exchange operation that was just a racket. The priest got a portion, the king got a portion, everybody else got had. Part of the reason that a monetary value of the ram that was to be used in the sacrifice had to be set was that in the asham offering for sinning against the Lord and being aware of it, there was an additional amount to be added as a penalty. And that amount was 20%. So, how do you give a ram plus 20% more of a ram? Well, the idea was the 20% would be given money in shekels. So the ram was assigned a monetary value, let's say 100 silver shekels. And then the worshiper was required to add another 20% to it. So, in my example, he'd bring a ram plus 20 silver shekels as his total asham offering. Eventually, it became possible to simply give the temple the monetary value of the ram plus 20% instead of producing an animal. Verse 16 ends with these words: "He shall be forgiven." The worshiper was absolutely absolved from this sin by God if he confessed his sin, came forward with a contrite and repentant heart, and produced the required reparation offering. You see, the sacrificial system was not defective. It did exactly what it was supposed to do. Next week, we'll continue at verse 17 in Leviticus chapter 5.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.